Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, we take a look at new content from the Center for Literary Publishing and invite editors and authors to read and discuss the work coming out of the center. My name is Megan Pipe, and today, editorial assistant Alice Stouffer and I dive into the summer 2017 issue to read Samantha Story's Voices Underwater. In the second half of the podcast, the perfectly named Story will join us via phone from New York to chat about her work. Stay tuned. Happy summer, podcast listeners. Today I'm so excited to be here with Alice Stouffer, and together we are going to read and discuss and think about Samantha Story's Voices Underwater, which appears in the summer issue of Colorado Review. Alice, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Typically, we chat for a couple minutes about what we love about the story, what we're interested in, but I think that, to use a pool metaphor, I think that instead of talking more about the story, we should just dive right in and listen to Alice read it. And then afterwards, the author, Samantha Story, is going to join us via phone from New York to talk about the story itself, her influences, and about those adolescent summers and how magical and strange and important they seem to be for all of us. So stay tuned.
Voices Underwater by Samantha Story.
That summer, we hardly ever left the pool. We dropped stones and shells into the water to make a real ocean floor. We pinned fern leaves to our hair. We dove and shot across the surface like mermaids on the run, squeezing our legs into long tails. Some days the pool was Atlantis, or the Lake of Excalibur, or the River Styx, or the Sargasso Sea and its sunken ships, all the magical places we'd read about in sixth grade that year. Other days, it was a sacred spring. We were two vestals, hooded priestesses collecting water for the temple under a clear blue sky. Sometimes we pretended you were the priestess and I the inductee. You poured water over my scalp as I tilted back my head and promised to be devoted forever and ever. We decorated the pool ladders in daisy chains, dandelions, and black-eyed Susans that got torn off by the high school girls, then wilted and dried out on the concrete. We belly flopped into the pool, splashing the high school girls on purpose. We dove to the bottom of the deep end, our ears exploding from the pressure. We played Olympics, spinning in somersaults off the diving board and judging our performance. We leapt off the white plastic chaise lounges, the picnic tables, the pool ladders, our legs splayed long like frogs. We floated in the pool so still, our long hair fanned in feathers. We looked up at the sun with our eyes wide open. Back then, we didn't care how we looked in bathing suits. We were afraid of nothing. It was the summer we worked for Stephanie at her camp. Stephanie Bouillard was a star. She had made it to the finals of a huge tennis open in New York City when she was only 19. For a year after that, she couldn't even walk through our little upstate town without people stopping to congratulate her. We treasured the Sports Illustrated with her on the cover, her face all golden in sunlight, her arm, long and tight in muscles, reaching up to the S of sports as the ball launched from her palm, a superhero ready to fly off the page. The issue date, September 7th, 1983, a launching pad. We knew the story inside by heart, how her mother died giving birth to her, how her father, Ron, raised Stephanie on his own, teaching her how to play tennis in the parking lot of his car dealership. That summer, the magazines were 5 years old. Our mothers were secretaries at Mr. Bouillard's car dealership. They loved to tell us the story of how they became friends all those years ago, and we loved to hear that story, because it was the story of how we became friends, too. How my mother fixed your mother's broken typewriter ribbon, and how, once they started talking, they couldn't believe they both had girls the same age. But in the telling, they left out the part about how our fathers both left. Yours when you were a baby, mine when I was 3, and the part about how both our fathers never came back, because no one liked that part of the story, not even us. Mr. Bouillard was the one who suggested we help out at the camp, and our mothers thought they had won the lottery. You girls are so lucky you get to be Stephanie's helpers this summer, our mothers said as they dropped us off that first day late in June. Can you believe it?
You girls are going to be working for the greatest tennis player in America. We couldn't believe it.
Especially those first 2 weeks of summer vacation. They went by slow and fast. When Stephanie talked, even when she was just telling us what to do, time shot past us. The sound of her voice slipped into our ears and ran up into our brains, translated into instructions for chores, but our eyes were darting, seeking out the details that defined her.
Her diamond stud earrings, her black sunglasses, her tennis dress with the yellow piping on the hem, her short blonde hair, the freckles on her arms, her bitten down nails, the scar on her heel that ran up her leg, the muscles on her right arm twice as big as the left.
Each piece of her a new treasure we'd discuss later in the pool when time had slowed down and stopped.
We had a routine. Every morning after our mothers dropped us off, we cleaned the pool.
Leaves and debris were everywhere. We dipped long nets. We filled huge plastic buckets with rotten leaves that blew in from the woods. Grass, petals, and twigs stuck to our bathing suits, our toes, our calves, our wrists. Then we waited for Stephanie. We scooped water into tennis ball cans we found in the trash, whispering pretend prayers at the diving board, a converted altar, to pretend gods who lived in the trees, in the sky, in the water. We watched Stephanie as she walked down the path to the pool from the big house, where she lived with her father, her blonde hair glinting in the sun, too bright to look at for long. She leaned against the diving board, and as we looked up at her, we saw ourselves reflected back in the plastic lenses of her sunglasses. Two girls looking right back at us like two different girls we couldn't believe were us. She gave us instructions. Check the pool's filter traps for frogs that got stuck inside. Scrub the picnic table umbrellas with the stinky cleaning fluid that smelled like chemicals and roses. We sighed and pretended to complain, just to get her to stay and talk to us more. We were just about to dive in before anyone gets here, you said, looking at the empty pool, the water flat as glass. And I copied your voice when I said, please, just 5 more minutes. We loved looking at Stephanie up close, the tiny diamonds that floated in her earlobes like singular stars. Come on, Stephanie said, with raised eyebrows and a smile, tugging gently on the ends of our braids. Pretty please? Her sweetness washed over us like warm water. Stephanie looked at her watch and went inside to her office. We went back to the pool and scooped up warm, slimy frogs from the filter traps, their bodies panting in our palms. So fragile, we were afraid of squishing them to death. The high school girls arrived in cars they were given for their sweet 16s. We watched them as they arrived, their tanned caramel calves, thighs pale at the top from their identical tennis skirts we dreamed of wearing someday. Their rackets rested on their shoulders like rifles as they marched down the path to the locker room. They never got leaves stuck in their hair or bleach stains on their bathing suits. They were going to be tennis stars. At least, that's what Mr. Bouillard told them at the beginning of the summer. By the end of the summer, girls, you'll be amazing, just like this one here, Mr. Bouillard said, squeezing Stephanie's shoulders. Or rather, could have been amazing, he added, winking. He leaned into her ear, his nose brushing her cheek. His dry lips puckered into a quick kiss that sounded like a slap. Stephanie didn't flinch. Stephanie's neck turned red. We both touched our cheeks as if we could feel his dry lips, too. I would have given my left arm to see you win Wimbledon. Hell, I'd have given my left leg, Mr. Bouillard said louder. Hello, second mortgage. He was pumping her shoulders as if they were flat tires in need of air. I'm just kidding with you. Coulda, woulda, shoulda, right? He said into her ear and kissed her again. Right, girls? He slapped Stephanie on her butt before he walked away up the path to the big house, the back of his neck bright red. Mr. Bouillard had converted his summer house into the camp, making the pool house into locker rooms and an office, and building another tennis court. A small wooden sign hung above the back door, the Adirondack Tennis Camp for Young Women, and it swung like a wild pendulum when he slammed the door behind him.
Stephanie took out one of her diamond earrings. She wiped the stud on her shirt and then put it back in the hole. "You know he's just joking with you all," Stephanie told the high school girls as she adjusted the earring, her words pouring into the air fast, like water falling from a tap, the high school girls and you and me drinking them, thirsty for sounds other than the silence.
Stephanie said she'd meet everyone at the courts in 5 and told us to put away the nets. Then she went into her office and closed the door. That summer, the camp was only a year old, but it had been 2.5 years since Stephanie's accident, since she stopped playing competitions. Stephanie was in a big tennis tournament in Australia when it happened. We were in the 4th grade, watching the game in your living room, our mothers on the sofa, us on the floor Indian style. Stephanie was up 1 set, 6-0, and 2-0 into the 2nd set when it happened. Stephanie lunged for a shot, but her legs went from straight to folding in a flash. She sat back up, trying to pull up her sock. But it wasn't her sock she was trying to pull up, our mothers explained to us later. It was her Achilles tendon, which had snapped. You gasped, and your eyes bloomed in tears as you watched Stephanie struggle to stand, and I gasped, to be like you. But the tears did not come. Just like a rubber band, you said of her heel, your hand covering your mouth. We felt for our own tendons and inspected them at the top of our heels, this guilty part of our bodies we had no idea could betray us. We kept that Sports Illustrated, too, the one that said, "It's over," on the cover, and showed her crumpled on the ground, a sharp, bright tear rolling down her face. Every morning, we pretended to clean the locker room when the high school girls were getting ready for their tennis lessons. We didn't really need to Windex the walls, because there was a cleaning crew who did the hard stuff like the toilets, but having an excuse to listen to the high school girls, to watch them and study them, was what we really wanted. The high school girls brushed their hair into tight ponytails that pulled back their hairlines closer to their ears. They drew black eyeliner under their eyes and painted their lips glossy, making them look thick and wet. Later, we wondered why they wore so much makeup, just to play tennis. They were only 4 years older, but they looked like grown-ups. They wore bras they bought in the women's section at the department store.
They stored tampons at the top of their lockers without hiding them.
Their legs were smooth and shaved, unlike ours, still fuzzy with yellow wisps. We studied their bodies as if they offered answers to the mystery of when ours would change to be like theirs. We wanted to be just like the high school girls. We wanted to wear dresses like theirs, lip gloss and bras with lace trim on the straps. We wanted breasts to fill them. We wanted our own cars when we turned sweet 16.
We wanted expensive trips to Europe so that when we went back to school, we could talk about where we went on summer vacation.
We would talk about how we also took lessons from Stephanie. Yes, that Stephanie, we'd say. We wanted that, even though playing tennis was the furthest thing from our minds, a cost we couldn't possibly imagine asking our mothers. We wanted these things in our own private silence. The high school girls' names were printed on their lockers, white on blue plastic tape we polished with paper towels. Karen McIntosh, Jennifer Walsh, Rachel Freed, Gina Johnson, Tara Whitman, Julie Vecchi, Melissa Connor, Debbie Patel, Susan Linden, Lisa Aglio, Christina Baldi, Ginger Chan, Jody Martin, and Ursula Fisher. But Ursula had more talent than the rest of the high school girls put together. One afternoon, when all the other high school girls were up on the courts, Ursula came down to the pool. We swam back and forth, trying to kick like dolphins, our feet pressed tight together, our spines arching above the surface as we wove in and out, stitching a line across the water. Ursula never said good morning to us when she arrived, so we were surprised to see her standing at the edge of the pool, looking down at us, one hand tucked behind her back, clasping the inside of her other elbow, an open soda held cold against her thigh, dewy with condensation. "Have you girls seen Stephanie's earring?" she asked us, an eyebrow raised like an accusing teacher. "Stephanie asked me to ask you both about it." "We didn't know," we said. And we really didn't.
But already we were imagining what it would be like to find it and return it to Stephanie. We waited for Ursula to leave, but she just stood there, sipping from her soda. "Why don't you play tennis with us?" Ursula asked, looking down her nose. She honestly wanted to know, she said. I sank down and sucked in water and spit it back out warm, the chlorine coating my tongue. When you said, "We don't have rich daddies," I sucked in and spit out again, the steaming arc landing on Ursula's sneakers, the sound of the water hitting Ursula's laces like a dog peeing on a tire. Ursula stepped back and cursed at us. We swam fast to the deep end, breaststroking beneath the surface. Bubbles fizzed off our legs, our long hair waved behind us. But even underwater, we could hear her shout, "Dirty bitches," the words clear and sharp in our ears. No amount of water cleaned away her voice. On the other side of the pool, gulping for air, you flicked her away with a wet finger. Sometimes we slipped rocks into our bathing suits, our bodies deformed and bumpy, the sharp stones pressing into our hips, our stomachs. We held exercise bricks as we jumped into the deep end, dropping fast. Lying on the tile at the bottom, we looked up at the surface, a blue ceiling that rippled and heaved with the high school girls above us, like flying naiads. On really hot days, Mr. Bouillard showed up after lunch like an unwanted guest. "Slow at the dealership," he'd say, explaining himself as he sank into the water. He drew lines of laps above us, an angry Poseidon. We studied his body, skinny legs, white round belly. We laughed when we saw his wrinkled penis floating out from the sleeve of his bathing shorts. When it felt like our lungs might split open, we shot off the bottom in tandem torpedoes, 7 feet through the blue, willing our mouths closed as bubbles streamed from our nostrils. At the surface, we gasped and inhaled buckets of warm air. Sometimes our nipples flashed when our bikinis were not tied tight enough. The high school girls laughed and pointed. We splashed them, and Stephanie's dad told us to cool it as he watched us fix our suits, not looking away like he was supposed to. We had no concept of our beauty or youth. Our hair smelled like chlorine and strawberry shampoo. Sometimes, when Stephanie coached the high school girls, we snuck into her office, paper towels and Windex, an alibi. The room used to be a guest bedroom back when the place was still Mr. Bouillard's summer home, but the furniture set had never been taken away. We snooped through everything, every drawer, every surface, every closet, looking for pieces of Stephanie. The bedside tables were stuffed with cans of tennis balls. The dresser overflowed with magazines, Sports Illustrated, Tiger Beat, 17, Cosmopolitan, all dated from 8 years ago when Stephanie was 16, the same age as the high school girls. "Would we have been her friend then?" you asked, as we opened more drawers and tried to picture her back then, teenage Stephanie, alone in her room. We pulled out the magazines from the drawer, and we squealed when we discovered 3 Playboy magazines at the bottom, the most recent issue, that month, July 1988, on top. "I'm going to lock the door," you said, putting back the other magazines and turning the metal lock on the doorknob. I looked out the window to check that Stephanie and the girls were still up on the courts. They were there, girls in white dresses chasing tiny yellow balls like clumsy puppies. We climbed up onto the bed and leaned back against the wall, legs straight out. You spread the magazine across our laps like a blanket, left side on your thighs, the right on mine, the glossy paper cool on our skin. So many breasts, all different shapes and sizes. We had no idea. We had seen our mothers and the high school girls, but these breasts swelled with pointy red nipples as large as plates, so pointy and hard they looked like the knots of balloons. Then, a pulse. A thrumming above our collarbones, our ankles, and high between our legs, a drumbeat that came from nowhere, our bodies more awake, more alive than ever. You laughed, and I laughed too, because we feared what sat in the silence. We laughed at how the models posed. We mimicked their mouths, pushing out our lips. We stuck tennis balls in our bathing suits and pretended they were breasts. "I'm so sexy," you said. You cupped the hard balls. You dropped your mouth open like one of the girls in the pictures. We posed in front of the full-length mirror behind the door, holding our tennis ball breasts in our palms, the glass smudged in fingerprints and powdered in dust. We looked at our faces up close, the brown of our eyes, the freckles on our cheeks. You held your arm up over your head to inspect your armpit, tugging on the 5 or 6 dark hairs that had appeared there last year.
I was the one who suggested we sit on the floor to look down there. You paused, only for a second, as if I had asked you to jump off the high diving board, a dare you couldn't resist, and you sat down like you were falling, spreading your legs in the same motion. We opened our legs wide, moving the fabric crotch of our bathing suits to the side. Can you see anything? You asked, your fingers holding yourself apart, but I couldn't see beyond your fingers and fabric, even though I was dying to see. That area still an illustration from a biology book, an oval with a straight line like a coffee bean. We wanted to see the holes, the anatomy of the folds. We wanted to see what we were about to become. We felt no shame. We were still soft and smooth children's skin. The slamming of locker doors cut the air. The high school girls, I said, as our bodies leapt up without thinking. The doorknob rattled. Stephanie's voice, loud and impatient, asked what was going on, and we said, "Nothing, nothing, nothing." You unlocked the door, and Stephanie pushed it open, hitting the wall. "We were cleaning the mirror," I said, my tongue a thick piece of chicken, clumsy and in the way. "We were cleaning your office," you said, waving at the furniture. We grabbed the Windex bottle from the top of your desk.
The Playboy magazines were exactly where we left them, gathered in Congress, as if all the naked women were having a meeting.
We willed Stephanie not to see the magazines, but she was already gathering them off the bed. The world stood still. Air floated in our lungs, neither in nor out. The high school girls in the locker room, Stephanie by the bed, the clouds outside the window hung in the sky, paused in their race to the horizon. We heard Stephanie talk low.
She told us to get out, and when we didn't move straight away, she growled the next time she said the get, a snarl, the out, a grunt. We shot out of the office like water from a broken dam, and we laughed uncontrollably as each and every one of the millions of nerves in our bodies released everything we held inside, like confetti from a rocket. The pool was our church, our confessional. It heard our secrets and kept our promises. We made them in the early morning before the clouds burned away. We held on to the bottom rung of the ladder and shouted out loud to be heard, our voices swirling and dipping, slow but bright. Our voices underwater could say anything. Our voices underwater said what we couldn't say to the air. You said you saw your mother and her boyfriend doing it, and they cursed at you to go away. I said, my mother cries at night when she thinks I'm asleep. Why does she do that? We promised not to tell a soul. We crossed our hearts. We hoped to die. We swore when we grew up, we would be different. We swore we would leave and never come back. We swore we would have families with a mother and a father. On the hottest days, when even the shade of the woods was too warm, we slipped under the house into the dark and musty crawl space where the air was cool and smelled like wet leaves. We could hear everything in the rooms above us through the thin floorboards. The high school girls in the locker room talking about trips they had planned for Labor Day weekend. Stephanie talking to the high school girls about her plans to compete next year. Their voices so close, their feet just inches from our faces. Sometimes we heard Ursula call her mother on the office phone and say she was going home with another girl after practice, but really she just stayed at the house with Stephanie. Sometimes we heard Ursula and Stephanie talking in the office. Sometimes we heard crying. Sometimes we heard moaning, like someone was in deep pain, but we knew they were not. We knew they were lost in a kind of pleasure we couldn't even imagine. We knew what they were doing. "Girl and girl," you said, like a question. A big question, the word girl hanging between us like a cloud. So many truths coming undone like a broken necklace of beads, each ball of glass crashing, crashing, crashing. One afternoon at the beginning of August, when the rain had sent most of the high school girls home, Stephanie invited us into her office. We were sitting under the diving board with piles of leaves and acorns we had gathered as pretend offerings in our game of Vestals. The diving board an altar, our towels around our shoulders, our priestess's uniforms, when she shouted for us to come inside. The pool blurred in points of gray as we walked to her office. Stephanie gave us towels to dry off. She was all smiles, all arms swinging, her muscles rolling. We both looked at the dresser and then at each other as we smiled with our eyes, so happy to be invited in. "How about I teach you how to wear makeup?" Stephanie said, as she reached into the drawer and pulled out a small red bag we hadn't seen when we searched her desk. "You're old enough now for this sort of thing." When she handed us eye pencils, it was like being given the keys to a new car, a pass to a private club, an open door into Stephanie. We laughed as we tried to draw around our eyes. "It's not a crayon, girls," Stephanie said, grabbing the sticks. "This is how you do it." We watched her stretch her eyelid, her jaw slack and her mouth open so we could see her fillings and the stains on her teeth as she looked into the pocket mirror she'd set up on her desk.
"I used to use the waterproof kind when I was competing," she said, like she was instructing us, and we ate up every word. "You have to look your best for the cameras." We nodded. "You have to look your best for the cameras," we thought, a new rule we filed away with how we were supposed to act when we grew up. She sat down on the bed and turned your face to hers as she applied the pencil to your eyes. "What was it like?" you asked, the drumming of rain on the roof filling the long pause Stephanie took to answer. And I listened, the pattering in time with me wishing I had been the one to ask Stephanie about being a star.
"Everyone wants you. Everyone wants to know what you think, what you like, what you love," she said, while brushing the pencil across your lid, her face only an inch from yours. You probably could feel the heat of her breath on your face, and right then I wanted to be you so much it hurt my ears. We were shocked when Stephanie snapped the pencil in two. She threw the pieces in the garbage. She kicked the bin. It tipped over, spilling out envelopes and papers and the broken pencil. "No point in makeup anymore," Stephanie said, walking out of the office, slamming the door behind. Hearts bashed inside our ribs, Stephanie, a wild animal, outside. As we picked up the garbage and kept the broken pencil for ourselves, we found a letter from a doctor in New York. The paper, smudged with fingerprints and wrinkled in corners as if it had been held tight, carried sentences that blurred together, but these words in black type, "no longer fit to play," jumped and crackled off the page like wood in a fire. We tore the page into 1,000 pieces, as if breaking up the words could make what they said go away. We thought we had that much power. On the days of no clouds and the sun too bright, we swam in the creek in the ravine. We swam naked because even our bathing suits were too hot. When we peeled them off, I apologized for my breast, the one that had started to grow before the other, and you told me not to worry. You didn't care. You said you wished your breasts would just hurry up and start growing already, instead of being just little mounds. In the shallow water, our backs touching silt and stones under us, we floated in the coolness and grew silent. We didn't say it out loud, but Stephanie was on our minds. We thought of how we waited for her to come down to the pool before we ran and jumped flips, just so we could see her clap for us. We jumped the highest when she was there. The way the brown of her eyes grew almost black near the water. The way she smelled in the morning when her skin was still damp from showering. You turned onto your front and asked me what I was thinking about, and I said nothing, and you said you were thinking about nothing, too. When we climbed out of the water, the silt from the creek coated our arms, our legs. Standing up, you bent down and scooped up more, applying it to your face, rubbing circles into your cheeks, your eyes bright white against the brown clay. I did the same. We rubbed our bodies with the clay all over, our necks, hips, thighs, chests, our hair, until we were plated. We stood facing each other, two carved stone statues, purple and wet and shiny. You took my hands in yours, and before I knew what was happening, you kissed me on the lips. I felt the pressure of your mouth against mine, but I felt it travel down my neck. I felt it in the palms of my hands, my ankles. The memory of it, even the next day and week, every time I touched my lips where yours had been, a shot of pleasure and pain welled in my chest as I replayed it in my mind. We both laughed when you pulled away, breaking the sound of the water whispering in the creek. The cicadas that had held their breath for that single moment let go in a crescendo of music. September and school were only theoretical, as impossible as alchemy. When the cleaning crew was at the pool and we couldn't swim, we'd watch Stephanie coach Ursula at the courts. Stephanie coached Ursula separate from the other high school girls. She was that good, the high school girls said, as if we needed to know why Ursula got special treatment. Stephanie hit shots to Ursula over and over, backhand, forehand, up to the net, away from the net. Our heads moved where Ursula moved. We sucked on Skittles and watched Stephanie and Ursula like they were a movie. The grass was yellow from the sun,
and sharp against our legs, but the candy melted on our tongues in red and purple sugar. Crickets jumped between us, the sounds of the balls knocking in the hot air, even and steady in our ears like water lapping on the shores of a lake, back and forth. When the noise pattern of the balls changed, we noticed Ursula had slowed down. She missed her shots. Her face was red and sweat dripped off her nose. Her eyes squinted tight as she tried to hit back the balls Stephanie flung, but she kept missing. "Why are you even here?" Stephanie shouted at Ursula. "Why are you wasting my time?" Stephanie stopped moving. She tucked her arm behind her back, cradling her elbow. The Skittles in our mouths tasted sour, the sweetness burned. Ursula just stared back at Stephanie. "You're not even remotely talented," Stephanie said. "You're just an ant, a tiny little worker ant that can carry a million times its weight but be squashed flat by a dirty shoe," Stephanie spat. Ursula looked down at her feet. We knew she was crying because her chin was shaking. We did not move. We did not blink. Ursula was all marble statue, no flesh, unreleased. No one moved until Stephanie walked away, throwing her racket at the net as if she were in the middle of a big game. We sat so still. We breathed. Ursula breathed. We spat out the Skittles, half-melted candy in the gravel. When Stephanie had left, Ursula turned to us and shouted, "Go away!" We did not move. "Just go away," she shouted again, running towards us, her tennis racket raised above her like a spear. We ran into the woods, leaving Ursula and the puddle of Skittles behind. Later that afternoon, when the high school girls and Stephanie were back on the courts practicing, and Ursula was part of the high school girls again, we went into Stephanie's office and tore off every cover of her Sports Illustrated collection. We crumpled each page into a ball. We left them in the trash in the middle of the room. We loved to play Olympics. We were divers competing for the gold. High flips, pointed toes, no splash, got the highest points. On the diving board, three steps, knees bent, and we shot up into the sky, turning our bodies back down before slipping into the water. We did it over and over until we realized a few of the high school girls were watching. We only went higher.
Stephanie joined in.
By then, we had forgotten about her and Ursula. She pretended to be the judge. She scored us. We dove. She scored us again. "That's a 7, she shouted at me. "Come on, you can do better than that. I want to see a 10. Everyone watching me. I loved it. I stepped 1, 2, 3 to the end of the diving board. My feet pushed down. My body dropped. The surface of the water right there, my body reflecting my red bathing suit, my brown braids. And then I was gone. In the sky, knees to chest, chin to knees, spinning and unfolding, piercing the blue. No splash. Swish and glide. Everyone cheered. "You next. Your turn. Your first dive was all legs. Too much splash." Stephanie booed. "You stood back from the edge of the board and studied it before you stepped and leapt and rose to the sky in a perfect arc. You slid into the pool like a needle. Claps and whoops, your face all smile when you climbed up the ladder, but Stephanie's mouth was a tight, straight line before it broke apart into, "I think you can do better than that." And you took it. You were going to show her. I was whistling and cheering until I saw you land on the board too close to the edge. Without the pressure of your toes to push it down, you lost your thrust back up. You tried to nose down what little upshot you got, but the momentum was gone. Your body was a comma instead of an exclamation point, the head of the comma hitting the diving board on your way down into the pool. I could tell by the amount of splash how much it hurt to hit the water. You disappeared into the deep end and didn't pop up, and I held my breath, willing you back up, glued to the cement like in nightmares where I can't move or run away. I saw you down in the blue, and I saw a black veil of blood wafting around you like smoke. Stephanie was the one who saved you. She dove in with her sneakers on, pulled up your pale body, laid you down on the side of the pool, and when you still didn't take a breath, she was the one who gave you mouth to mouth, tilting back your head and sealing her mouth around yours. I stood there, beside the diving board, across the pool from you, and watched how she pressed down on your chest and pumped air in and out. I saw Stephanie kiss you again, and then again, her thin pink lips touching yours, her tan hands holding your nose shut and cradling your chin until you coughed. I watched Stephanie help you sit up, her arms, your face, her slim fingers wiping off the water, or maybe tears, from your cheeks.
I sat across from you both on the floor in Stephanie's office. You were you and Stephanie. You and Stephanie leaned back on the bed. you and Stephanie against the headboard, waiting for your mom to pick you up.
I pulled out a magazine from the dresser, but neither of you looked at me when I opened the drawer. When Stephanie put her arm around your shoulders to hold a towel to the gash on your head, I heard you sob into her neck in a baby voice. I watched your hand grope out from under the towel, reaching for hers, and I saw her take it. She held it up to her chest, close. Of course I was jealous. I am guessing you have a scar from that day, a souvenir of that summer. I have no such memento, nothing I can touch.
It was almost Labor Day when they drained the pool. At first, they covered the water in a giant blue canvas while they waited for the county to come inspect it. And then one day, the water was gone, emptied overnight.
No one knew exactly why. The high school girls blamed your blood in the water. You can get AIDS, you know, the high school girls said. Ursula said it was because you almost died. Stephanie said they'd fill it back up again soon.
We thought, this is what they do when an accident happens. We thought Stephanie teaching tennis to a bunch of high school girls at her father's summer house was normal. We thought the club was normal, that all girls and no boys was normal. We thought 2 12-year-olds working for Stephanie was normal, too.
We stood at the edge of the pool. The ladders led down to nothing. The diving board was dismantled from its frame, lying on the ground like a broken toy. We should have been sad, but we weren't. We jumped into the shallow end, running our fingers across the side of the pool, moist with morning dew, as we walked to the deep end. At the bottom, all the stuff that had been dropped in the water over the summer lay scattered. The band-aids, barrettes, and soda pull tabs, and in a puddle by the drain, a dead frog, swollen in the hot sun, its white belly gray and bursting. I was the one who saw the earring first, glinting in the sun on the blue tile. Stephanie's earring, I said, holding it up. But the joy I thought I'd feel at finding it didn't appear. The back of the stone had browned in rust, and one of the prongs that held the stone in place was bent. It made no sound when I dropped it into the drain, too small to even plop. You looked at me and said nothing, and I said nothing too. Your silence an apology for something you didn't even do.
The next day, we saw Ursula knock tennis balls against the wall of the deep end of the pool, the echo of rubber bouncing off cement, hollow and wooden.
We didn't think anything of it until later. We were alone in the locker room, spraying the locker doors, even though the high school girls weren't there yet, their lives no longer that interesting to us, when we heard what sounded like shouts of pain outside. Through the fuzzy, hot air, in the shade of the locker room overhang, we saw Stephanie pushing to and fro, her calf muscles in tight balls against Ursula, her back against the wall of the pool, her tennis racket on the ground. Whines and groans, the only sound in the air, hovered above the pool, their voices alive like sad music. Ursula's tennis dress was up around her ribs, and we saw how Stephanie's hands were sandwiched between their bodies. In the late summer light, it took a while to understand what we were seeing. Tingles in our privates, pinpricks of pleasure shot through our bodies as involuntarily as knee jerks. Our hearts beat fast, while what we watched went slow. I was the one who told on Stephanie. I was the one who took the path up to the big house. You waited by the pool. Too shy, you said, to talk to Mr. Bouillard. When he opened the door, he didn't invite me in. He just stood there on the threshold, white shirt, white shorts caught up around his thighs, his floating penis hidden under the fabric. I watched Mr. Bouillard's face as I explained what had happened, searching his eyebrows, his nostrils, the corner of his mouth, but his muscles stayed put like rocks in the woods. They were doing it in the pool, I said,
wondering where I had learned the language to describe what we had seen.
I see, he said, combing his fingers through his hair. Anything else? And because he asked a question, and because I had this need to answer any question, even though I knew I should have stopped talking already, I kept going. Stephanie has porn in her dresser drawer. Breasts, tied off like balloon knots, flashed behind my eyes. I rubbed my thumb across my wrist to keep my hands still. I see, Mr. Bouillard said again. Then he just stared at me, right into my eyes without blinking, and I wanted to look away, but knew I had to hold on, my tongue touching the roof of my mouth as I said, hold, hold, hold without sound, and looked right back at him. Mr. Bouillard told me I had made a mistake. Mr. Bouillard told me I had imagined what I saw. Mr. Bouillard told me to run along and get back to my little friend so we could play. Mr. Bouillard patted my cheek. He said, you're a good girl. A really good girl, as he shut the door, the wood panels peeling at the bottom. That summer, sex was everywhere. It was in the finger holes of the pool filter covers, in the hollows of the trees. It was a duck, biting the neck of a hen while they mated in the creek, and the red-tailed hawks above them, locking talons in a skydive, coming apart only right before they hit the ground. It was the Barbie dolls you brought in from home that we stripped and knocked plastic and naked against each other while we laughed. It was the rabbits we saw copulating in quick, tiny thrusts before they came apart and acted like nothing happened. We thought sex was violent and messy. But a few summers later, when we were at basement parties, in the arms of high school boys in darkened rooms on mildewed sofas, too ashamed to say where we wanted to be touched, too scared they wouldn't like us if we told them, we came to first know sex. We smiled and said to those boys, yes, that felt amazing, even when it did not. We learned to enjoy it only later, much later. I drove past the dealership the other day. I thought of you. The water that summer is what I remember most of all. The fabric of it on my skin, the way it has felt since then, my body ageless in its light hammock, my feet in the surf, my hands under a tap washing, the back of my neck in the rain, and always the pool. I've never left the pool. Have you?
I'm here with Alice.
Hi, Samantha.
Hello, Alice. How are you?
I'm quite well. How are you?
Good.
Awesome.
So one of the things that struck me most about this story was the way that setting is informing both the two main girl characters and also the conflict of the story. I loved how everyone sort of existed in separate worlds that overlap with each other. And I was curious if setting was something that was really at the forefront of your mind while you were writing the story, or if it's an important craft element that is at work in your other works or works that you're drawn to?
That is such a good question. I think I should start with the seed of the actual story, which was I read Lydia Peel's Sweethearts at the Rodeo. Do you guys know that?
No.
No, but now it's on the list.
So that is another story in which it's sort of a pivotal summer, a pivotal moment with two similar girls. And I read the story and I was like, I love the story so much and had lived that summer myself. I mean, not to the same degree that the girls in her story had, but I feel like summers were so important. I grew up in England and my mother's sister is from upstate New York, and we would go to New York every summer and hang out with her, and there was nothing like a club or anything like that that I described in the story. I mean, obviously I've fictionalized stuff, but those summers were really pivotal, and I wanted to write my own version of that summer after I read Lydia Peel's version of her summer. So setting-wise, yeah, that really did inform it. Summer is such a time of, especially for kids, of transition and transformation, and I know I felt that as a kid, and kind of went to that place, I think, for that reason.
Wow. I'm curious for you. I mean, so it's one pivotal summer of transformation for these two girls. For you, kind of like living that summer in adolescence, was there one year or like one age of life that you think was really pivotal in that way, in the way that it was for your characters? Or is it like an unfolding thing that you can only see in retrospect, which I guess makes me also think about the distance that our narrator has talking about that summer? I'm trying to form that into a question.
No, I guess, it's also a really interesting point, because the great thing about using a summer to tell a story in is it's a nice sort of limited amount of time. In reality, I don't think I've ever had anything that neat and tidy.
Right.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm used to, I don't even know, I don't remember what it was like to go from being like a kid, and I do remember, so let me back up. I do remember becoming super aware of what I looked like in a bathing suit. And I think that's part of this, I mentioned that in the story, yeah. That there was just this sort of moment where you don't think about it at all. And then all of a sudden you are thinking about it. And I think that is that, I don't remember what age I was, but I think that's sort of when that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think I have toyed around with that moment before in other stories, and they've not come through very well, but placing it in one summer really helped just from a structural point of view, because there's a beginning and an end, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that whole, just what you said about the sudden awareness of, like yourself in a bathing suit, and the story gets, so complicated too, by the fact that there is this, this male gaze from Stephanie's father, that just creates another layer of like danger and conflict in like becoming a part of this, like adolescent female world. That was like scary and really just beautifully rendered.
So. I think that that's another thing you become aware of, especially just as girls, like how dangerous the world is.
Yeah.
And I grew up in central London in the 80s, and it was pretty gritty back then. And I was very self-conscious. I mean, the attention you'd get, back then it wasn't called sexual harassment, and we have like nice good labels for it today, but I definitely was aware of how uncomfortable I felt sometimes in public.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to, I don't know, I'm not that, I don't want to frame it like I'm really conscientious about adding these things into a story, because so much of it is like subconscious and comes out when you're actually creating the characters and what they're experiencing. So, mm-hmm. And that's the magical part of creating fiction, you know, like you just kind of go with it and then things like that appear and make sense.
Yeah. And I love how you described that kind of like magic of the creation process. Cause I think especially, Alice and I are both fiction writers too. And the way that, you can only explain so much of what ends up happening on the page. And so much of it just, it happens because that's where the story like leads you to, and you just kind of have to follow it sometimes and then see afterwards what is rising to the surface.
I think what I ended up with when I initially did it was a lot of nothing happening, really nice descriptions of things going on in their world, but nothing was challenging them. And when I went to rewrite it, it was introducing conflict that was so important, and figuring out like making stuff happen to them and making them grow. And that was a real struggle, because I could spend hours just describing place and things happening that don't really move anything along, and that can get really boring for a reader, you know?
Mm-hmm. Love it. I was really curious. So so you're a reporter as well.
I am. I'm actually an editor and lead a team of reporters. So being on this end of the phone call is really uncomfortable. And I'm holding back wanting to ask you all kinds of questions about yourself. Tell me more about your fiction. Tell me more about like where you're from. But do go on.
Oh, fun. Well, I was reading Amy Hempel's Paris Review Art of Fiction interview a couple weeks ago, and in it she was talking about how her background in journalism and reporting informed her fiction, both in like her love of interesting facts and also the way that she front loads, I guess, like the conflict and like a lot of the just like the good stuff of a story, because she's always prepared for the reader to run away. Just trying to like get them to stay with her throughout a story.
I love that expression, for the reader to run away.
Yeah. That's, and that so you're just like clinging to them. So I was curious, either, are there similarities for you as a fiction writer who also works in journalism, or are there other, sort of like lessons or things that have informed your fiction, from that other aspect of your life?
Oh, I love this question. Yes, in many, many ways. I think that for this particular story, I relied a lot on memory of place and memory of feelings. But for other stuff I've been writing, it's really fun to sort of go down the rabbit hole of history and figure out what's going on in the world back then. And I do love those facts and creating and looking back on that time with 2020 vision and placing your character in that time and kind of drifting it. The other problem I do have, though, is being a journalist, the writing is based on facts and is not florid in any way. So sometimes I'll be writing and it just feels so disconnected from the character, and I have to, I mean, I can't remember what, there was a writer who said, like, that they were, there's aspects of when they're writing and when they're typing, if that makes sense, and I feel like sometimes I'm just typing and I'm not really going in deep enough,
yeah.
And that's the easy part about being a journalist, is, like, you're just telling a narrative of facts, and you're trying to draw it together, of course, with, like, also good storytelling where you don't want the reader to run away from the story, but in fiction, it's, you have to go even deeper than that. You have to get into the emotions of your character, and every single sentence has to reflect that character and that character's growth. So that's where all the rewriting comes in.
Yeah. Which was so lovely to me. I loved like the invocation of we, that just like came up as a repetition so many times, just as a way of like looping these girls together and their experience and their summer. So on a sentence
was,
level,
and
it was lovely.
And I have to say, I copied that from Lydia Peele. Like, hers was a we as well.
Ooh.
And it again was something, you have to read the story. It's so, so good. And you're going to see how the spirit of my story is so influenced by the spirit of her story. But my, I also went to an all-girls school. So my female relationships growing up were so, so, so important.
Yeah.
And I always felt like a we, like my, the close friends I had in the summer, the close friends I had during the year, like, it was never an I. It was, especially at that age, it was always like, we are together, you know?
Yeah.
It was almost like, I mean, when I look back on it, when it, even, I mean, if it wasn't even romantic, it was still this sort of like level of intimacy that was almost like a emotional, like, it was like emotionally romantic. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So first lovers, and when you're older, I do remember falling into this trap of saying we a lot and hating myself for it. I lost myself, like me as an I, but back then when you're kids, it's just like, it's similar. It's almost like you're practicing for that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
I think for me, something that separated the two and created that I voice outside of the we was that the narrator seems so much more invested in storytelling and like creating a narrative than her friend does. And that might just be that we're getting this story through her perspective, and it is in the shape of a story. But that was something that struck me as I was reading, that while these characters are in play and even the act of retrospectively looking back on this summer, this narrator is just really interested in creating a good story. And I wondered a little bit about what that might tell us about her at the present. This adult narrator who comes forward at the end of the story to admit that she's never left the pool. I was really fascinated by that admission at the end of the story, that this narrator feels still sort of a part of her is alive, reliving that summer over and over again. That was really interesting to me.
Oh, I had never thought about that. That's such a good question. trying to think. Yeah, it's sort of, when you do go back to that place, though, that place of, like, being in a pool or being somewhere that's really familiar with your childhood and summertime, I think it's a place of comfort, and I think that's where that was coming from. I think as an adult, you get used to, gosh, how do I say this without sounding incredibly cynical, but adulthood's really hard. It's a lot harder, but you kind of get used to all the shocks of loss that comes with adulthood and trials and tribulations that come with adulthood, whereas when you're a kid, those are all very new or just haven't even presented themselves to you. So if you're in the idea that she sort of goes back to the place is almost like a safe haven. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have not thought about it from that. Again, it's just like subconscious, you know?
Yeah.
But I hadn't thought about it in detail, so.
I love that, though. And the last line, the have you, it, when the first time I read it, it made me think about the friendship between these two girls, now women. And I wondered, like, are they still close, or is this like a reaching out after so many years? And of course, we don't know that. And I love that we don't, in a way, because yeah. It is like such a story of memory. But I don't know, just made me wonder, like, where their friendship's at.
Yeah. I like that it opens the story out, definitely. That it feels like there's a world that exists, and we get a glimpse of it with this story, but I can imagine further that these characters are alive and walking around.
Mm-hmm. I think of them as not being in touch, because it's so very hard to keep in touch with those childhood friends if you move around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I do... Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to sort of, I think it's fun for other people to think of where they are now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But you know where they are too.
I do. Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. And we don't need to know where, but I like that you know. We don't.
That should be a little mysterious, but I think it's best left to mystery.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. I agree.
Something that the story reminded me of, I had many summers at summer camp and camp counselors that I looked up to and idolized in a similar way that the girls look up to Stephanie in your story. And it just got me thinking about how that's sort of a weird relationship as you're like coming into adolescence when you're looking up to people who are just a little older than you. And I was curious if you had any figures like that that had maybe inspired this story or thoughts about those kind of little crushes that we have on grown-ups as we grow up ourselves.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Little crushes on grown-ups. That's so well put. Yeah. I feel like I was such a weird kid in that I made friends with a lot of grown-ups, and I would make friends on those plane trips back to the States. I would travel with my brother alone on the airplane, and I would look forward to the adults I'd sit next to and make them my friend and get their address and be pen pals with them. It's very weird looking back on that, but I found that in those, like, in random pen pals I made, but also in teachers that I had, there were a handful of teachers I felt very close to growing up, and they were crushes, weren't they? They were almost like, teachers had a way of almost being like superstars in your imagination, like famous people. You know, when you mm-hmm. would, I remember back then learning their first name and that making them, like that was such a big deal to know their first name. And I definitely tapped into that with the Stephanie character. Mm-hmm. She's such an amalgam of all those teachers.
And I love it too. I mean, we get to see, I mean, the girls walk in on Stephanie at like her moments of vulnerability. And I mean, she's really brought down from superstardom to just like being a person, trying to figure things out and dealing with a lot of her own stuff. But I like that our narrator is retrospective, so she can realize that now. But the way that you've balanced the voice, she idolizes Stephanie while we still, as readers, get to see her as like a real and full human who's more complicated yeah. than this idol that the girls see her as, which is really lovely.
Yeah, I had a really tough time with that with the narrator, was getting the adult narrator back in there. It was very easy to hang out in the girls' world, but you need yeah. that adult narrator to control the story
mm-hmm.
and that adult narrator knows what's happening in real life, which is, I mean, her father is quite sinister and her career is just gone. And mm-hmm. and it, back then, like, tennis was so much bigger in the 80s than I think maybe it is as much now. Like, it was more popular, I should say, mm-hmm. like the characters in it. And I was sort of inspired by Tracy Austin, who was also very young and had great success at a very young age and then lost it due to injury. And she's, I mean, this is nothing like whatever Tracy Austin's biography ended up being, but gosh, what happens to that person who almost had it all or had it all for a brief moment? That's what I tried to put myself in her shoes a little bit.
Yeah, I loved that. Oh, well, this was so much fun. I'm so happy that we got to connect with you. Alice and I both have our copies of this summer issue in front of us now. Did you get your contributor one yet?
Yes, I did. And yay! I was thrilled.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. So are we. So it's been so much fun.
Yeah. This is my first actual fiction short story that's ever been published. So it's particularly special, and I'm really enjoying this moment.
Samantha Story was born in New York and raised in London. She works as a news editor and a fiction writer. Her journalism has appeared in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, and the Seattle Weekly. She has been recognized with an Emerging Writer Fellowship from the Center for Fiction. She lives in Brooklyn, New York with her family, where she is currently at work on a novel. Voices Underwater is her first published story. The Colorado Review podcast can be found on iTunes and at the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.